Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 9th, 2001. In the Creekside room this morning is Randall Mullins. Today's session number is MUR 2001-4, and it's titled, But What If? Will Nonviolence Really Work? Let's listen in.
Well, welcome, and thank you for coming. This material is so compelling and exciting. I'm not surprised that you're here. In another sense, Holden is so beautiful. I'm just amazed and complimented that anyone would come indoors to a class at this place. But thank you for coming. Let's see, a couple of announcements that I'm asked to always make is these classes, you probably know, are all recorded. They're available for sale in the bookstore and I think for checkout in the media office. There are hearing assistive devices. If, like me, you need a little electronic wizardry to help you hear better, and it's available in the media office too if you need those. Let me just mention on the back table there are lots of handouts. Some of them are kind of my handouts session by session, and you'll kind of, if you're not able to get to the session and you want a sampling of Wolfram Wink's work from different parts, you can grab one of those and just kind of, you can see what the subject headings are. I really want to, there are two books in the bookstore that I asked the bookstore, and I wanted to teach a course and know the books are right there if you want them. I really just can't be enthusiastic enough about Engaging the Powers. It is a book of stories, excellent and accessible biblical scholarship, stories of nonviolence, philosophical, mythological background, and Walter Wink's own personal inner life journey, which makes me respect him the most. He's not just a man who's done his homework in his head as a biblical scholar and teacher. He's done his homework in his stomach, I like to say, as an activist and as a man of prayer. So this is a great book. It's the third in a trilogy on the powers that Walter Wink is now very well known for. But there is a compendium of the three called The Powers That Be. It's a shorter, more popular version. There's a copy of it back there on the table. The bookstore has it too. So Engaging the Powers and The Powers That Be are good books on Walter Wink. They're here for sale. If any of you happen to be in the Seattle area, I'm going to be teaching this again starting in September, and I'm working with some friends, especially to gather activists from within the church and outside the church in Seattle together to study together. So often we're organizing and working and sometimes demonstrating together, but we don't study together nearly as much or pray together. So this is one attempt to do that. If you're in the Seattle area and can take a brochure and help spread the word, I would be grateful. I do a newsletter out of my Center for Contemplation and Nonviolence. There are copies back there and a little pink piece of paper if you'd like to be on my mailing list. Love to have you. So just put your name and address, etc., back there, and leave it there on the table. Another thing I want to just plug very strongly, and I used it yesterday with some hesitation. I just found those of you who are there can be the reviewers. But this wonderful organization called Ecufilm, based in Nashville, has a 7-video series with Walter Wink, Jim Forbes, and Janet Wolfe, who's an inner-city pastor in Nashville, or at least she was. But it's a wonderfully done. So if for adult classes in your church, if you want to take Walter Wink work home, the 800 number is on all the handouts to order this, as well as the titles of all the books. And finally, just one more, Vern Rossman, a wonderful Disciples of Christ teacher and scholar in Oklahoma City, has a website in which he has 12 study guide sessions on Walter Wink's work that you can just download. And his web address is also on the handouts. So today's session is entitled, But What If? Will Nonviolence Really Work? And I want to ask if you will do something with your body, which this brother is doing right here. Will you just cross your arms a minute and see how that feels? Get the whole room. And this is just an experiment, not to be cute, but I suspect most of you in this room are already advocates of nonviolence. But I just want to invite you, or even urge you, to try to be as skeptical as you can for this hour. I want you to toss your Christian faith and your values out the window. I want you to pretend you're a veteran of three wars. You were in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. Maybe you even were in the Persian Gulf. All, you know, you're old enough. Maybe you were a consultant in the Persian Gulf. You were all four of them. And you know what war can do to protect what's good in this country. You know that when push comes to shove, violence is what counts. So it is just as best you can. I just want to invite you to just play with pretending that that's your position, if it's not already. And I know for a fact that it's not for some of you. Here's a person who I wish were here today. He can't be here because he's in prison for life. He's my friend Bill. I work twice a month with prisoners at the Washington State Reformatory. Very interesting life story. Bill is, and I don't know of any direct connection, although there could be, but so I don't want to overanalyze this. Bill was the former commander at the Trident nuclear submarine base in Bangor, Washington, near Seattle. And he got involved in a crime of passion and stabbed a man about 100 times, and so now he's in prison for life. But he's become a good friend, and in fact, inside the prison with these men with life sentences that we work with, he's a real gift because he's a scholar, obviously a leader, and a very caring man with the other prisoners. And I told him that I was involved in a protest at the Trident nuclear submarine base, and he says, "Oh, that's good, Randall." I said, "You know, that's what we were doing there, is protecting this country so you people would be free to protest." That's a strong argument. You know, we may laugh a little bit, but that's a strong and persistent argument. So I want to bring Bill's voice in here. I wish he were able to be here in person to speak his voice and out of his experience as a commander of the sub base. Today, August 9th is the 56th anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki. And I haven't been able to retrieve the quote. If some of you know it, I'd love it, and can get it to me, I'd love to have it to me. What do you know about Nagasaki besides it was hit by an atomic bomb? Anything know anybody else about the distinction of that city? I don't know much, but one thing I do know is Nagasaki is the Roman Catholic center of Japan. And many of the people who were killed there, I guess in the history of the missionaries, was that St. Francis Xavier then? Do you know? I don't know. But in the history of the movement of Catholicism into Asia and into Japan, Nagasaki became the center. So a whole lot of the people who died on August 9th, 1945, were Christians. And one of them, after it was all over, had a quote that went something like this. I think it's Sick Psychology, but maybe Sick Psychology and Perfectly Good Theology. He said something like this: "What a privilege, what a gift it is for this many of the people of God to die so that this war can end." Now, that's a little different theology, isn't it, that said than the theology from the top in President Truman's office that said, "We've got to drop this bomb, no matter how many deaths, to protect American lives." I heard this week 400,000 prisoners of war were in Japanese concentration camps, and that they were all going to be killed if the U.S. invaded Japan rather than drop the bomb. So, according to one argument, that's how many U.S. lives were saved by dropping the bomb. What a privilege to die. What a privilege for the people of God to die. Is that the theology of the cross? Well, let me just tell a few stories and go step by step and put Walter Mink's case out here. What if it is surprising how few people have seriously considered nonviolence as a way of life and a strategy for social change? We are so inured to violence that we find it hard to believe in anything else. And that phrase, "believe in," provides a clue. We trust violence. Violence saves. Violence is redemptive. All we have to do is make survival the highest goal and death the greatest evil, and we have handed ourselves over to the gods of what Wink calls the domination system. We trust violence because we are afraid. And we will not relinquish our fears until we're able to imagine a better alternative. What if we are attacked by muggers? Probably someone in this room has been mugged.
They've been mugged?
No, yeah, at least one. It's not far away, is it? What if robbers break into our house? What if someone opens a toxic dump in our neighborhood? What if another nation threatens our very existence? What if an armed criminal attacked your spouse or a child? Unless we all start wearing sidearms, we would probably find ourselves incapable of responding effectively in many situations, whether violently or nonviolently. And even those who are armed sometimes find themselves helpless to intervene. The United States, even though it possessed more armaments than any nation in history, was utterly powerless to save East Germany in 1953, Hungary in 1956, Czechoslovakia in 1968, or Poland in 1980, or the Chinese students and workers in 1989. Violence didn't help. In fairness, let me back up just a little, get the whole paragraph. The problem with hypothetical tests for the effectiveness of nonviolence is that different presuppositions are allowed to predispose the outcome than those governing the choice of violence. For example, if we're considering war, we can assume at the outset a U.S. military force of 2 or 3 million trained personnel and a budget of $300 billion a year to back them up. In fairness, the nonviolence advocate should be able to presuppose millions of people trained in nonviolence and prepared, like soldiers, to give their lives if necessary for the sake of justice. In the Philippines in the 1980s, the number, I think, in Wink's book, Brad, I don't know if you know, but I think it's 100,000. I think that number may be high. I think Wink may have gotten it wrong, according to one other source. But 100,000 poll watchers were trained to be poll watchers, but also trained in nonviolent resistance in the Philippines in the 1980s. All of them willing to die if necessary to keep the election that overthrew Marcos from being fraudulent. It was the church did it, Catholic and Protestant. More Catholic there, of course. But they developed a nonviolent army of civilians in the Philippines. They trained them. Richard Dietz, now the editor of Fellowship Magazine, the Fellowship of Reconciliation, did training for many of the Protestant churches. So, can we preach? I don't want to crush your arms. You keep working here. I've got more of the power now. But don't, I got all the guns now, okay? So you're kind of the unarmed one right now. But some more here. The theory and practice of active nonviolence are roughly at the stage of development today as those of electricity in the early days of Marconi and Edison. A new source of power has been discovered and crudely utilized in certain specialized situations. But our experience is so limited and our knowledge so primitive, and I would add our consciousness so far from open awareness, that there is a legitimate dispute about its applicability to a wide range of complicated and critical tasks. I have to say that I'm in a place now where I'm wondering, is it so crude? Is it so untested? So my question to you skeptics with your arms crossed is not only might it work, but has it already worked? And is it already working?
Well, I think about 1975, 1995 in Seoul, Korea, the students would often protest against the government. And there'd be armed clashes with the police that were often very violent, and it was getting more violent. And so the police said, we're going to have all the secretaries out there. It's just going to be women that will be holding back the students. And it changed the whole tone of the protest because they were just women that were just holding back the protest. You couldn't fight against them. You couldn't throw rocks against them.
The Korean police made that?
Yeah, the Korean police. In Seoul, Korea.
That's my first time to hear that story. Now, you're not being a very good skeptic on the other side.
One more thing. You know, the police in England don't carry guns, as I understand it.
That's changing, I'm afraid. I've heard that.
Well, but maybe we had to change it. You know, I think we should have all our police dressed as Mickey Mouse. You know, how it would change the emphasis of police in a lot of the cities where they're the heavies.
Clown noses. Yeah, there's a black officer on the St. Louis police force who's a consultant to other police forces now and training in Kingian nonviolence methods. So these things are happening. Let me read you a story by a woman. I just realized this morning. And I read and I reread Wing, but I'm not very smart in just retaining the stuff. There's so much in this book, so I've been living with it 6 years and just getting started. But I just realized this morning, Angie O'Gorman, who wrote this story, had been steeped in nonviolence and rehearsing it and thinking about it and in her own prayer life. And this is what happened to her. Some of you have heard this story, but please hear it again. O'Gorman describes being awakened late one night by a man kicking open the door to her bedroom. The house was empty. The phone was downstairs. He was somewhat verbally abusive as he walked over to my bed. I could not find his eyes in the darkness, but could see the outline of his form. As I lay there, feeling a fear and vulnerability I had never before experienced, several thoughts ran through my head, all in a matter of seconds. The first was the uselessness of screaming. The second was the fallacy of thinking safety depends on having a gun hidden under your pillow. Somehow I could not imagine this man standing patiently while I reached under my pillow for my gun. The third thought, I believe, saved my life. I realized with a certain clarity that either he and I made it through this situation safely together, or we would both be damaged. Our safety was connected. If he raped me, I would be hurt both physically and emotionally. If he raped me, he would be hurt as well. If he went to prison, the damage would be greater. That thought disarmed me. It freed me from my own desire to lash out at the same time from my own paralysis. It did not free me from feelings of fear, but from fear's control over my ability to respond. This is a woman who's been training herself to think and act and feel and pray nonviolently. From fear's control over my ability to respond, I found myself acting out of a concern for both our safety, which caused me to react with a certain firmness, but with surprisingly little hostility in my voice. I asked him what time it was. He answered. That was a good sign. I commented that his watch and the clock on my night table had different times. His said 2:30, mine said 2:45. I had just set mine. I hoped his watch wasn't broken. When had he last set it? He answered. I answered. Time seemed endless. When the atmosphere began to calm a little, I asked him how he had gotten into the house. He'd broken through the glass in the back door. I told him that presented me with a problem as I did not have the money to buy new glass. He talked about some financial difficulties of his own. We talked until we were no longer strangers, and I felt it was safe to ask him to leave. He didn't want to, said he had no place to go. Knowing I did not have the physical power to force him out, she knew. She'd been trained and thought to realize enough violence won't work here, not practical. Knowing I did not have the physical power to force him out, I told him firmly but respectfully, as equal to equal, not victim to attacker, equal to equal, I would give him a clean set of sheets, but he would have to make his own bed downstairs. He went downstairs, and I sat up in bed wide awake and shaking for the rest of the night. The next morning, we ate breakfast together, and he left. In Wink's commentary, by treating her intruder as a human being, O'Gorman caught him off guard. Conversation diffused his violence through the effects of prayer, meditation, training in nonviolence, and the experience of lesser kinds of assault. She had been able to allow a context for conversion to emerge. My colleague Killian Noe says that the purpose of spiritual practice is to make us accident prone. It means it makes us ready when enlightenment or awareness or conversion is ready to find us. It makes us ready. So this was Angie O'Gorman's moment, I think. She had been rehearsing nonviolence beforehand.
Was he held responsible for his actions?
I'm sorry?
Was he held responsible?
He doesn't tell us in the rest of the story, I don't know. But there's a footnote. If you want to find this and research it, I'd love to know. There's a footnote to the story in Wink and Engaging the Powers, and I can give you the page number later. So.
She never saw him again.
Is that just...
That's, yeah.
Is that what you heard?
Mm-hmm. That's what Walter said.
Okay. Brad, by the way, was with Walter Wink. Brad was with Walter and June Keener Wink, his wife, in February this year, so he can amplify in other conversations much of this. So, but he's leaving tomorrow, and I can change that.
There was kind of an interesting dialogue in the Other Side magazine, which they have out here, where people had instances like this and perhaps could not avoid the guy being prosecuted and went to the trial or did not press charges and ended up befriending them, both with good and bad results. And sometimes it was just the start of a really change in both of their lives, and other times it just blew up in their faces.
I noticed you said this worked when she knew that violence, she didn't have the power to overcome him. I'm just thinking, you know, is America willing to do that when we know we have the might to put our thumb down on little nations or whatever? I mean, what's the psychology there? You know, it takes a stronger person to walk away from a fight, and yet we have the power and we flex our muscles.
That's right. And we're the empire. We're the only superpower.
Right.
But I think that's an important question. Listen to this in response to that question, because it struck me anew today. Can whole societies learn to be less violent? Maybe not a total conversion, but just violence reduction methods is another principle that's being, you know, if we can't end violence, can we just bring it down a little? There's some positive indications at the international level. A uniting Europe is itself evidence that one of the most strife-ridden areas in the world can learn to live peaceably together. Lithuanians had fought a guerrilla war against the Soviets until 1952, expecting Western aid that never came. I didn't know that. They lost 50,000 lives, and 400,000 Lithuanians were sent to Siberia. I guess you could say practically, in terms of efficiency, saving lives, violence wasn't working very well, was it? After the deportations and the night of our genocide, our people realized that armed struggle was not the way. We needed to rely on patience and nonviolence. At that point, the invisible nonviolent, I guess that means underground, nonviolent struggle began, one Lithuanian remarked. Despite the threat of Soviet military force, leaders from the top down, including the Catholic Church, urged the people to remain nonviolent and to maintain a spirit of love. The movie Gandhi was widely viewed and highly influential. The Lithuanian Department of Defense went some distance in committing itself to a policy of nonviolent national defense against the Soviet Union, and the faculty of the Police Academy explored nonviolence with Captain Charles Alphen, that's the black policeman from St. Louis who teaches Kingian nonviolence. He went to Lithuania to help train their policemen. Gene Sharp, who teaches at Harvard, I think, is still there. Richard Dietz and Robert L. Holmes actively consulted with the Lithuanian government as it raced against time to devise a comprehensive nonviolent national defense. A defense that worked when in 1991 the three Baltic states won their independence.
Whatever happened to those 400,000, were they returned?
Where? Lots of great questions, I don't know.
Well, what's the methodology of these instructors to this country, I guess? What did they do?
Some of my training is limited. There may be some people in here who can answer this question better than I, but in nonviolence training, one of the famous parts of nonviolent training is a harassment line. Is if you're a nonviolent person, now this is more in the context of protest. I know less about training policemen, but I can imagine some of it. But a harassment line just means the protester is standing there and the other people training, you go along and you shout in their face and you spit on them and you tell them you dumb, stupid. I mean, you just try to humiliate them so that they really get the feeling of what it means to stand there and take it lightly. You've seen the people on the lunch counters in the early civil rights movement. So you know, they were instructed to stand there and take it. If they pour coffee on you, you let them pour coffee on you, and you take it. Others, can others answer Bill's question? You may have. I don't know exactly what nonviolence training would look like with a police force, but be sure.
Well, I've been in a shelter system, and we were trained in nonviolent methods, because, I mean, you start taking on a child that's been pretty much abused their whole life. Yeah, I mean, you're no win. I mean, basically, that's where that one is.
Yeah, if you get enough.
Right, and so you make choices as to what is conflict, what isn't conflict, and so you have to deal with it in a positive way and create an atmosphere in a positive way, and you will get positive results, including some of the real strong, hard gang kids and people that bring guns to schools and everything else. And you just, do it on a positive way. Mm-hmm. And it works. And I'm just saying, is there some similarities in the armed forces? Of course, these are all new people that hadn't seen each other, or maybe they are people that are community neighbor friends. You know, and the point is, why are we taking on if there is no particular reason to take on? I mean, yes, you might have a personal judgment that you believe this is wrong. Okay, then you have to find ways and people to coalition, which is the greatest method is coalition. The more people, the less conflict you're really going to have to deal with this whole stuff. Now, if you've got Russia coming down on you, I mean, there's not a lot you can do about it. I mean, you just get the hell out of there, put it bluntly. I'm just asking here. I don't know the solutions, but I do know it really works if you just don't take on situations that aren't really beneficial to you or the other individual. So
just don't
pass a method in one thing. And I'm trained this way, and it works. I mean, I never had. We started this whole agency, and we had takedowns. We had kids that were in a forceful situation. We had 2-3 people that had to hold them down to get them calmed down. Don't get them to that state of mind. In other words, you got to sense it when it happens, before it happens, and then you start working accordingly. Separate them, time out, that always works. And maybe this is what has to be done with the police system. But I would like to know how they handle the police systems, and I think a lot of our schools need it, and I think a lot of our communities need it in many, many different ways.
I always bring that up with our liaison officer when he comes to our classes, and he's wearing a 45 or something, and like you said, why?
You teach in
a high school in Minnesota.
High school,
and he's just visible, fully dressed. And we talk a lot about that, how women make better police officers because they are better talkers. Men, in general, tend to not be the diffusers. They throw gas on the fire, and that just comes to blows. And so a lot of he talks about that, the women in the police force are sent in, and it's better for both. The violator, he's not going to go to prison. He's not going to get the woman, usually. And it's better for him. If he pulls out a gun and starts shooting at a man, he goes away for a longer time.
there, I think there are incredible implications in this for male spirituality and the mythology. One of the things Wink makes a very strong case for in the mythology, which is in all of our psyches, which it's male domination. You know, that's deeply there from the beginning, and it's not good for the deepest positive meanings of what it means to be a male, nor for a female. So that's what that reminds me.
The skeptic in me, I'm a social worker with kids adjudicated to a placement, but the skeptic in me says that, like the conversation the woman had with the intruder at 2 in the morning, is great, except when the intruder is on drugs and not rational. And, you know, if you've got somebody on crack, or it's really tough to have a rational conversation with somebody who's chemically altered. And what is the response at that point? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that? And and as the gang involvement has been so much drug-based, then the de-escalation that you were talking about has a real different take on it. Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah. We need to be asking those questions. Or in, I don't know if any of you know the Bronx, we don't quite have, we've got some tough things going on with the Seattle police force and the black community right now. But, you know, I'm told that there are places in the Bronx and Harlem where the police just won't go. It's too dangerous for the police, you know. So what happens, you know, and we all were encountered with a drug thing. Let me tell a couple of stories here. May I, in response to that, if I can find them quickly, I think I can. What if, this is not quite drug related, but your question reminds me of it. What if a gang of thugs is harassing villagers in the Philippines and the police do nothing about it? Does one kill the thugs? Vigilante? Killing would excise the tumor, perhaps. That's what Americans like. We like surgical strikes. Just a little bit of violence, get it over quickly and efficiently. Send the bombers in, wipe them out, come home, celebrate the victory. Killing would excise the tumor, but would develop no antibodies in the system to stop its recurrence. What could the people do? They had the numbers. They were like ants, says Niall O'Brien. They could swarm over these thugs and stop their behavior nonviolently. If they failed, someone would shoot these petty criminals and simply confirm others in their worship of the gun. So the people from the churches went, 1,000 strong from the entire region, to the home of a known killer and held a mass surrounding his house. The perpetrator was refused communion and ordered to leave the area. He surrendered all his weapons, disarmed his gang, and after talking all night, repented of his actions, which it turned out were supported by Marcos's army to discredit the real guerrillas. Now, that story succeeded. There's no guarantee that trying that in some other place wouldn't fail miserably. But I think the point of this is we have some options if we begin to imagine some different futures. What if in Seattle, in November, December 1999, and I know all you saw was kids in black masks and police using tear masks, that is not all that went on at WTO. It was the most well-planned, and I walked around and watched nonviolent resistance movement I have ever seen with an incredible organization and discipline. But what if they are in Seattle? What if the churches of Seattle had a nonviolent army, 5,000 strong? And all we did, we didn't go and try to say, you policemen, go home, we'll take care of this, although that's possible. But we just went and sat down in the streets. 5,000, but you got to have 5,000 to do that, you see. You got to believe in it enough. But other countries in the world are getting 5,000. They're not just getting 5,000. Listen to this story. Incredibly untold story. I didn't know this one until 2 years ago. Anybody know? Is Bad Shakan a new name for you? Don't be ashamed if it is. But let me just do a test here. Do you have in your mind a kind of a negative stereotype of the most violent image in the world today? I've got one. I don't know how strong it is for you, but I've got one of the Arab terrorist. You know, sometimes he got a patch over his eye or something like that. You know, what if I think of one of the places in the world, we know what's going on in Afghanistan now, the Khyber Pass and that whole part of Afghanistan, India. You know, that's one of the places in the world where traditionally blood vengeance lasting for generations has been practiced. You know, and now we're seeing it again with the Taliban in Afghanistan. And it was true of the people in what I guess is now Bangladesh. But something else happened in the 1930s. Listen to this. If we have done the work of preparation, we may find that simply suffering the brutality unleashed against us achieves more than we could have dreamed. In 1930, the arrest of members of Bhadsha Khan's nonviolent army by the British. Bhadsha Khan walked right alongside Gandhi, but very few of us have heard about it. He was a Muslim from that Khyber Pass area. His nonviolent army by the British ignited a spontaneous general strike in March in Peshawar in what is now Pakistan. British troops fired at the crowd of unarmed people who refused to give way and who continued to march forward to replace those who had fallen. The firing continued for 6 hours. 200 to 300 were killed and many more wounded, yet the Pathans remained nonviolent. The British were confident that such strong-armed method would crack the Pathan will. Yet where Khan had previously been able to enlist only 1,000 troops in his nonviolent army, now 80,000 new recruits flocked to take the nonviolence vow as a result of the excessive use of force. Just strikes me also is, I taught high school history 2 years, my first 2 years out of college in the inner city of Memphis. It just strikes me how out of touch the way we teach history is with at least what Christians need to know of the world. You know, we just don't know the stories because we've learned that American history kind of started, this is how I learned it, I don't know what yours was, but the stepping stones are the wars. It started with the Revolutionary War, and then the next important thing was the Civil War, and then the Spanish-American War was important enough to be a stepping stone. That was being addressed in World War I and World War II. That's how we frame our history in violence. You know, Howard Zinn is saying that's not the way to frame history if you want to raise a good society. So we're steeped in this.
Nonviolence didn't seem to help the Jews. I mean, they've really been nonviolent as a people, and how they've been persecuted, especially during the Holocaust. Nonviolence didn't seem to do them much good.
Oh, yeah. If you're dealing with what about Hitler? And this question is always a good one. Now, first of all, I just want to bring up Wink's point again in response to that. But I honestly got out of, I was doing a forum in one of the large progressive churches in Seattle. It wasn't Lutheran, so. and it made me go home and want to get ready for the next forum. I was honestly ridiculed out of that place. With an arm, that's why I told you I'm a student. There were 200 people with their arms folded. Nonviolence would have worked against Hitler, you idiot, you naive idiot. That's how I said. Would it have?
Well, it's interesting when the person in the movement most often identified in Lutheran circle, Bonhoeffer, and his implication supposedly in this plot to assassinate Hitler becomes often an illustration of justifiable use of violence, just war. This man was personification of such great evil, and nothing else seemed to be working. So desperate times called for desperate measures. And it raises some troubling and provocative questions, I think, for not only Lutherans, but for Christians and Jews and all people of faith. Because Bonhoeffer is held up as a martyr, as a saint, and I mean, we have no idea really what it would have been like in that situation. But that is often pointed to as sort of the paradigm of faithfulness in the midst of that terrible time in Germany.
Let's stay with Bonhoeffer just a minute. Bonhoeffer is incredibly important to me in this very conversation. Anybody amplify what Brad has said about Bonhoeffer or say anything else? I expect there are a lot of us in the room who've been touched deeply by Bonhoeffer's story. I'll just say a couple of things for myself. Gandhi said, you have to choose between cowardice. You feel that cowardice and violence are your only two choices. Choose violence. And Bonhoeffer, I understand, some of you will know the story better, at the time he was trying to get to India to meet Gandhi, to talk with him in person. He was trying to find a nonviolent way. And for me, the Bonhoeffer story is what he left us, what, just weeks before the war ended, is what he was saying?
Days. Yes. April 9th, yeah.
So, and when did the war end?
6 days later, the Allies came in.
6 days, yeah. I didn't realize. But he left us his debt. And that's what Daniel Berrigan says, that was Bonhoeffer's gift to us. And not only did he leave it, but that wonderful story of when the guard came and said, Mr. Pastor Bonhoeffer, come with me, and everyone knew what that meant. He turned to, I guess, a British prisoner and says, some people think this is the end for me, this is the beginning, this is the end. That's how deeply Bonhoeffer had internalized it and had been able to say, we can't care more about our own innocence and guiltlessness than our brother. I mean, that's an incredible life. So I think Bonhoeffer's spirit and mind was able, and his body was able to hold it.
Wasn't that the awful truth? Is that, I don't know if you're advocating never violence or almost never violence. Jesus never really supported any violence. We have the guy losing his ear and he healed him. But is that, are you advocating, I'm almost embarrassed to ask you. Mm-hmm. You advocate never violence? And once you, I think it's more mature to say, it's almost a new fundamentalism, never violence, just like it's fundamentalism and never thinking to say, well, violence is the answer.
Yeah.
Power, control, military, whatever. But is it more mature to say, yes, very rarely violence is an answer? Are you saying that?
I'm not sure I've ever had anyone ask me that question, Tom, but...
How about the money changers, though? I mean,
those are just tables.
Property damage.
Okay.
Was he angry or was he not? John Deere, the wonderful Jesuit.
I'd like you to answer that question. Would you advocate never or?
Well, I have to say I don't know right now, but I'll respond to the question by saying I come from, one of the reasons I feel like I'm trying to be in this work and in this conversation is I've got a history of some very difficult anger management and some violence of my own, and I think God often calls us to our own pain. So I'm probably just trying to heal myself, you know, at the very beginning. I'm not advocating any easy answers.
Well, I have a problem with absolutes. The only one I buy is God's grace. And I'm coming from where you are is that, you know, go back to your example. If nonviolence was the system that in place that would work, perhaps it would have prevented Hitler's rise, you know, using your analogy. Wouldn't his spiked violence of his removal,
I'm sorry,
his spiked violence in the nonviolence movement, since the nonviolence was not in place at that point, mm-hmm. have had everyone's attention to say, better way. Mm-hmm. I just have a trouble with saying, absolutely, this is the only way. Yeah. I think you're given an ability to reason. And at some point, unless you're willing to die, which to me kind of defeats the purpose of getting a good system, it doesn't affect you very well. You know, there's no payoff for me to die.
That always comes up with when they throw your kids, your very own children are being attacked. Oh, what would you do? I mean, would you stand back and let it happen?
Sometimes.
When it affects you personally or your own self. Could you tell us a little more about, you talked about the nonviolence in Nazi Germany and the King of Denmark?
I want to get to that. Let me just stay with this right here just a minute, because I think this is a helpful point. I want to come back to Wink's point that nonviolence is where electricity was in the early stages, that it's just beginning, and that another point he makes, I don't think we've said here today, is that where violence has been the way to try to bring in, for months and years, and a part of the structures and the infrastructure, to bring in nonviolence at the last minute and expect it to work is just naive, and it's not going to work. And, I think I would probably say that in relation to Hitler. At the same time, nonviolence did work in a number of cases against the Nazis. And you probably know the story, don't you? But I'll just tell you two or three quickly. Le Chapeau, the story of the French Huguenots, and it's a wonderful video and book. And my colleague Killian Noe has just written a children's book on the same story she's trying to get published. But 5,000 French Huguenots who have centuries of a sense of being persecuted of their own in Roman Catholic France and southern France and Burgundy, suddenly in the 40s started having Jews show up in their village where they had a school, had their own school there. And so for them it was a kind of a matter-of-fact assumption, if you're a follower of Jesus, this is what you do, you take care of people. So they began to make fake IDs and developed an incredible system to save the lives of 5,000 Jews. And the evidence seems pretty strong from the video called Weapons of the Spirit. You can find it. Seattle Public Library has it because I asked them to get it. Weapons of the Spirit. A lot of evidence that Nazi officers knew what Le Chambeau was doing and looked the other way. And what is your name?
Jay.
Jay's comment about Denmark is, the Nazis ordered everyone in Denmark, all the Jews in Denmark, to wear the Cross of David to identify themselves. Well, everyone in Denmark started wearing the Cross of David.
Star.
A little fuzzy. I guess the King of Denmark himself.
He's a star.
Hitler was mentally ill, basically, and he was put in there as a puppet control of the whole Nazi things. Now, there was a lot of support people underneath him to put him in there in the first place. Okay, from a non-violent standpoint, could you get a possible coalition? I don't know enough about the history of the so-called support generals and whatever have you under him. Wives, significant others, friends, work around the so-called control mechanism, not with any country. You have the so-called leaders and work around them and start influencing that way. Is this even a possibility in Nazi Germany? I mean, am I even thinking wrong on this one?
Well, again, I don't think nonviolence was developed in Nazi Germany in history to the extent that it is even today. That's what worked in that's what worked in the Philippines.
That's what I'm getting at.
17 years ago. That's what worked in India in 1930, and that was the time. And that was a non-violent army of 80,000 formerly violent, culturally violent people. Mm-hmm. So what I'm advocating, Tom, and may not be the most significant question for me. It's just to say, we followers of Jesus, we got to look at this stuff. Real hard evidence in history and stories that have been told. Were you going to say something?
One of the points that Walter Wink made in February over and over again is that it's so often the case that it is out of weakness that people gather together and become strong in nonviolent resistance. Even the passages from the Sermon on the Mount assume an oppressed people under the Roman authorities. And so he kept challenging us as not only Western people, but Americans who do have all of the guns, how can we even begin to de-escalate, not to mention eliminate, but de-escalate violence as the first course of action in light of Jesus' teaching, given the position of power that we enjoy. I was listening to a tape by Walter Bowman, who's a Lutheran theologian, reflecting on the Persian Gulf War, and he read somewhere afterward a Christian publication that had the title, America is a Man Again. And there were churches where soldiers in camouflage came marching down the aisles with their... So Christian churches in this country clearly are not of one mind as to the myth of redemptive violence. You know? So that's 9, 10 years ago. It's disturbing stuff.
I was wondering if you could get a group of body of soldiers from the Lutheran Church. You know, I mean, that's a topic. Peace is a hot topic for pastors, I'm sure, to teach about. And it's the same with parenting. We've all been faced with, I mean, spare the rod and, you know, spoil the child. And then you got, okay, so when is it okay to spank? You know, and I know this is going down to a family level, but, you know, you so many things. It's never okay. And that's how we've always believed. And luckily, our kids have never pushed us on that. But, you know, we were able to verbalize with a two-year-old. I mean, that sounds silly. But to say, hey, you can't go on the street because this is what will happen. And most people say, nope, there's an almost never thing where you can't hit. It's okay to hit then. And I was like, huh? This isn't...
Well, let me tell you what, though, here's a place maybe to read Wink's quote. Sound like some of you will disagree with this. That's healthy, I think. Christians can no longer regard war as an extension of policy, but as a dangerous anachronism destined for oblivion in the new nonviolent order of God. No doubt the objection may be raised that affirmation of nonviolence by the churches would be simplistic, that ethical judgments in the real world are far too complex, Bonhoeffer, that's my footnote on here, to adopt a fixed ethical stance. This objection, I must confess, was one of the main reasons I resisted committing myself without reserve to nonviolence for so many years. I've slowly come to see that what the church needs most desperately is precisely such a clear-cut, unambiguous position. I think he must be talking about what the Quakers and the Mennonites and the Brethren already have. A clear-cut, unambiguous position. Governments will still wrestle with the option of war, and ethicists can perhaps assist them with their decisions. Mennonites in Nicaragua during the 80s, the U.S. Mennonite Central Committee had people helping the Contras and the Sandinistas talk to each other. So a pacifist church was very involved in the war, and helping out of their nonviolent identity to help with the situation of violence. What a position of authority the Mennonites have. But the church's own witness should be understandable by the smallest child. We oppose violence in all its forms, and we do so because we reject domination. That means the child will recognize no beatings. That means women will hear no battering. That means men will gradually understand no more male supremacy or war. That means everyone will understand no more rape of the environment. The church must affirm nonviolence without reservation because nonviolence is the way God's domination-free order is coming. I mean, do you know about Christian peacemaker teams? I think the Brethren and the Quakers and the Mennonites have gone in together, and they're based in Chicago, I believe, at least they do. They're training church folks to become nonviolent warriors. And these people are going to the AKs, and they're going to Bethlehem. They're going to places having been trained as nonviolent presence and sometimes risky places. So it's happening. The churches are starting to do this. So I don't know if someone in this room is going to start the first Lutheran militant peace force, but...
Onward, Christian.
Well, I think it's interesting, like you said, that we sometimes gather together out of weakness and then propose nonviolence. But like it says in Matthew, you know, we're about turning the other cheek. Then it goes on to say, but do good to those who do evil to you. Pray for those who persecute you. So that it's not that we're necessarily gathering together and going for nonviolence as a way of protecting ourselves, but to do good to others, as to do good to our oppressors. You know, and I sometimes think that maybe that doing good, like that case in the Philippines where they did the mass around that leader's home, was not to condemn him, but to seek his salvation in a sense, which he saw as non-threatening to him and led to his acceptance of them again, you know. So, I mean, if we, if we're thinking about how are we doing good to these people, we're not only in the defensive mode, but we're this is what we're called to do.
But Saddam Hussein, I mean, I'm not going to do good for Saddam Hussein. If I'm going to help anyone, how am I going to do good to him? I mean, how am I going to redeem him? I mean, this guy takes a member of his cabinet in the next room and shot him one day in the middle of a meeting. That's the story I got from a U.S. official.
Old relative, too.
Yes,
son-in-law.
Yeah, and faced him back into the country.
There's several examples.
Well, what is Saddam fear? What is it? What would be? What would we first? You'd have to define what would be doing good to him. What would be good for Saddam Hussein?
I think we should use the nonviolent method of sanctions against his country. I mean, we did all the bombing, but we should use the nonviolent sanctions.
That's a great idea.
And since he's such an evil leader, we will use sanctions which will kill his children. That's what we're doing.
I say elect him to our Senate or something.
We should
and make him feel really useless.
Or maybe we should take some of that money and just say, look, this is yours. You know, we'll just give it to him. Let him become rich.
Annex the country.
Huh?
Maybe
you don't want to make a state.
If you could do what the woman in your story did, sometimes when these people are encountered as people, now, that's very hard to do where he is, but there are some interesting stories where people that are enemies meet. I mean, look at Reagan and Gorbachev and whatever. Some things that come out of meetings like that where people get away from their positions and meet as people. I don't know when that's going to happen with what you were saying.
Are you suggesting we actually talk to him?
There's surprising things
that happen. Are you familiar with the National Peace Institute or whatever it is that grew out of the effort toward a peace academy? I just heard one of the people a couple weeks ago at our missionary conference talking about how I believe the Dayton Peace Accords somehow provided for like $15 million to be available for religious groups to help affect some kind of peaceful things in the Middle East, and the Clinton administration never used any of them because they thought religion was the problem, not the answer. But currently, there is some effort being made involving getting some of the Jewish leadership to speak to some of the Palestinian leadership, the religious leadership. And one quote that came from it was that this high rabbi and whatever the Islamic leader, they were persons in high positions and got them together to talk to each other. And they emerged from it, each of them saying, I have more in common with this man than I do with the fundamentalists that are in my party. So, recognizing that.
How does that?
The stories, the Israel Palestine, I was with a 32-year-old rabbi 2 weeks ago in Seattle named Eliyahu McLean. His daddy was a Presbyterian and his mother was a Jew. He was born in Hawaii and he grew up in Santa Rosa, California, and now he lives in Jerusalem. And he's got a prayer ministry. He's getting sheikhs and rabbis to talk to each other all the time. And 2 weeks ago, he and his prayer group were sitting near the Wailing Wall with rocks flying. And the soldiers cleared out everyone except you people praying can stay. We need you here. Leah Green in Seattle was a part of the Seattle area. She identified with the Israeli left until one day she realized if we didn't have an Israeli Palestine conflict in Israel, we would have a conflict between the Israeli right and the Israeli left that would be much worse. Mm-hmm. So she left the peace movement. She left the Israeli peace movement and started a new movement of her own where she gets I don't know exactly how she does it, but she gets Jewish groups from the U.S. especially, but mixed January, she got a Jewish-Christian UCC group going. And they stay in the homes of Palestinians, and they stay in the homes, and they're coming out of the store. This stuff is, that's the other thing, is this stuff is happening, but our media, they're not going to tell us about it.
Yeah, but they did mention where the youth, their youth were sitting and having their own connections, you know, Palestine and Israel. They were together, and that the media presented this in some form. I actually listened to it on TV one time, and they were actually a positive. This is a positive connection, and that's it's going on. It's just a matter.
But just count on it. I think for a long time, this is my assumption. It may be too cynical. I don't know, but I think the cameras are going to go where the violence is.
They always have.
And now we've got, I saw a wonderful magazine. I just met it out here from Jerusalem of Jewish and Palestinian youths working together. So an awfully lot is happening. And I know that, I think we're going to see more shootings in high schools in the near future. I don't think we're close to the end of that. But while all that's happening, I was a part of one of the best planned peace demonstrations in my 10 years of marching in the streets of Seattle, totally planned by high school students in Seattle this past April. A lot is happening, and the hunger for young people is. I've got a story in this issue of my newsletter of a high school youth who was arrested with his father last January on Martin Luther King Day, a protest for nuclear weapons. And this image of God, this seed, it's the religion of redemptive violence has taken us over, it's sort of been seeped into us. But Wink says, and I say, and I think the Bible says, get out of my Baptist history here, the Bible says we're made in the image of God. There's another seed in us that wants to grow. And we can choose to water it, or we can choose to keep being church like we've been doing it, which is sort of a vague extension of the domination system most of the time. But thank you for listening. We're going to stop and continue.